The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day two of this seven-day session already. It's amazing how quickly it goes when we concentrate. And I'd like to share with you today some of the writings of Jacques Le Serran. He's been mentioned before. He's the man who had a deep awakening experience while incarcerated in a prison camp by the Nazis, a notorious prison camp, Buchenwald. And I'll give you the beginning of the story first. When he was a kid, young kid, he was 8 years old, his eyesight wasn't the greatest, and so he wore glasses. And this was in the 30s at the latest. I think it was the late 20s. And that was before they started doing tempered lenses for glasses. And the kids were all excited, rushing out to recess one day at school, and somebody shoved him from behind in their enthusiasm, and he fell into the corner of the teacher's desk, and it put out his eye, and he went blind. And it's very interesting what he writes about this, and I'd like to share it with you, essentially in his own words, although he was French, so this is a translation. I started a couple of... Okay. Every day since then, which is when he went blind, I have thanked heaven for making me blind while I was still a child, not quite 8 years old. I bless my lot for practical reasons. First of all, the habits of a boy of eight are not yet formed, either in body or in mind. His body is infinitely supple, capable of making just the movement the situation calls for and no other. And this is important, ready to settle with life as it is, ready to say yes to it. And the greatest physical miracles can follow from this acceptance. From this acceptance. There he was, blind, permanently and completely blind. 3 weeks prior to the accident, he'd been at his grandmother's house in a different town, I think in a country town, and he was out in the backyard, and his parents found him crying. And they asked what was wrong, and he said he knew he would never see the garden again. So clearly he had some sense of what was to come. But as you just heard, he accepted what happened to him. He didn't rail against it. Rather, he explored learning how to live with it. Acceptance of the moment as it is, or at least as it appears to be, gives us a tremendous amount of freedom. It doesn't mean that if bad things are going on, we don't act to rectify them, or to get out of the way, or to change the situation. But it means that we're not railing against it in our mind. And that's a big difference. You remember Shirobunan, who was accused of fathering the child in very early Japan, and how it very nearly destroyed his ability to survive for the next year. And yet, he was in total acceptance of the fact that however it had come about, even though he was not the father, he was now responsible for raising this infant. How many of us could be like that in those situations? ready to settle with life as it is, ready to say yes to it, and the greatest physical miracles can follow this acceptance. He continues, I'm deeply moved when I think of all the people whom blindness strikes when they're fully grown, whether it is caused by accident or injury in war. Often they have a hard lot, certainly one harder than mine. At all events, I have other reasons, not material, for thanking fortune. Grown-up people forget that children never complain against circumstances, unless, of course, grown-ups are so foolish as to suggest it to them. For an 8-year-old, what is, quote-unquote, is always best. He knows nothing of bitterness or anger. He may have a sense of injustice, but only if injustice comes from people. For him, events are always signs from God. These simple things I know, and I know that since the day I went blind, I have never been unhappy. As for courage, which adults make so much of, children do not see it as we do. For a child, courage is the most natural thing in the world, the thing to do through life at each moment. A child does not think about the future, and so is protected from 1,000 follies and nearly every fear. He relies on the course of events, and that reliance brings him happiness with every step. And jumping around a bit, I recovered with a speed that can only be explained by my extreme youth. Blinded on May 3rd, by the end of the month, I was walking again, clinging to the hand of my father or mother, of course, but still walking and without difficulty. In June, I began learning to read Braille. In July, I was on a beach on the Atlantic, hanging by the trapeze, by the rings, and sliding down the slides. I was part of a crowd of children who ran and shouted. I was building castles in the sand. But I shall come back to this later, for at the time, other matters were more important. It was a great surprise to me to find myself blind, and being blind was not at all as I imagined it. We could probably say that about just about anything. Nor was it as the people around me seemed to think it. They told me that to be blind meant not to see. Yet, how was I to believe them when I saw? Not at once, I admit. Not in the days immediately after the operation, for at the time I still wanted to use my eyes. I followed their usual path. I looked in the direction where I was in the habit of seeing before the accident, and then there was anguish, a lack, something like a void which filled me with what grown-ups call despair. And finally one day, and it was not long in coming, I realized that I was looking in the wrong way. It was as simple as that. I was making something very like the mistake people make when who change their glasses without adjusting themselves. I was looking too far off and too much on the surface of things. And this is the natural state of affair of most adult human beings. Looking too far and on the surface of things. We live life a little bit like skipping a stone over the water. Here and there in contact with it truly, and the rest of the time hovering above it. And then we wonder why it's not fulfilling. We wonder why we're caught in all of our ideas and thoughts and assumptions about life. I was looking too far off and too much on the surface of things. This was much more than a simple discovery. It was a revelation. I can still see myself in the Champ de Mars, where my father had taken me for a walk a few days after the accident. Of course, I knew the garden well, its ponds, its railings, its iron chairs. I even knew some of the trees in person and naturally wanted to see them again, but I couldn't. I threw myself forward into the substance which was space, but which I did not recognize because it no longer held anything familiar to me. This is so much a map of practice. We are throw ourselves into the out-breath, or into the koan, or both, looking for something in the way we have been accustomed to looking for things before. But we have to look in a different way, as he discovered. At this point, some instinct, I was almost about to say a hand laid on me, made me change course. I began to look more closely, not at things, but at a world closer to myself, looking from an inner place to one further within. Looking from an inner place to one further within, instead of clinging to the movement of sight toward the world outside. When we can do this, our practice progresses very quickly. And not only that, but our life changes as well. When we can live from that inner sense, it's amazing how different it is for us, really. We're not caught there in our ideas about things. We're not caught there in our conditioning. In a sense, we're free when we move from that inner place, not depending on our normal way of seeing things. I'll read this again because it's really, really important. At this point, some instinct, I was almost about to say a hand laid on me, made me change course. I began to look more closely, not at things, but at a world closer to myself, looking from an inner place to one further within, instead of clinging to the movement of sight toward the world outside. Immediately, the substance of the universe drew together, redefined, and peopled itself anew. I was aware of a radiance emanating from a place I knew nothing about, a place which might as well have been outside me as within. But radiance was there, or, to put it more precisely, light. It was a fact, for light was there. A Korean master, Chinul, taught his students in this way. Turn the light inward and trace down the radiance to its source. Turn the light inward and trace the radiance down to its source. It was a fact, for light was there. I felt indescribable relief and happiness so great it almost made me laugh. Confidence and gratitude came as if a prayer had been answered. I found light and joy at the same moment, and I can say without hesitation that from that time on, light and joy have never been separated in my experience. I have had them or lost them together. I saw light and went on seeing it, though I was blind. I said so, but for many years I think I did not say it very loud. Until I was nearly 14, I remember calling the experience, which kept renewing itself inside me, my secret, and speaking of it only to my most intimate friends. I don't know whether they believed me, but they listened to me, for they were friends. And what I told them had a greater value than being merely true. It had the value of being beautiful, a dream, an enchantment, almost like magic. The amazing thing was that this was not magic for me at all, but reality. I could no more have denied it than people with eyes can deny that they see. I was not light myself, I knew that, but I bathed in it as an element which blindness had suddenly brought much closer. I could feel light rising, spreading, resting on objects, giving them form, then leaving them. Withdrawing or diminishing is what I mean, for the opposite of light was never present. Sighted people always talk about the night of blindness, and that seems to them quite natural, but there is no such night, for at every waking hour and even in my dreams, I lived in a stream of light. Without my eyes, light was much more stable than it had been with them. As I remember it, there were no longer the same differences between things lighted brightly, less brightly, or not at all. I saw the whole world in light, existing through it and because of it. Light threw its color on things and on people. My father and mother, the people I met or ran into in the street, all had their characteristic color, which I had never seen before I went blind. Yet now the special attribute impressed itself on me as part of them as definitely as any impression created by a face. Still, the colors were only game, while light was my whole reason for living. I let it rise in me like water in a well, and I rejoiced. I did not understand what was happening to me, for it was so completely contrary to what I heard people say. I didn't understand it, but no matter, since I was living it. A light so continuous and so intense was so far beyond my comprehension that sometimes I doubted it. Suppose it was not real, that I'd only imagined it. Perhaps it would be enough to imagine the opposite, or just something different to make it go away. So I thought of testing it out and even resisting it. At night in bed, when I was all by myself, I shut my eyes. I lowered my eyelids, as I might have done when I covered my physical eyes. I told myself that behind these curtains I could no longer see light. But light was still there, and more serene than ever, looking like a lake at evening when the wind has dropped. Then I gathered up all my energy and willpower and tried to stop the flow of light as I might have tried to stop breathing. And what happened was a disturbance, something like a whirlpool. But the whirlpool was still flooded with light. At all events, I couldn't keep this up for very long, perhaps only for 2 or 3 seconds. And when this was going on, I felt a sort of anguish, as if I were doing something forbidden, something against life. It was exactly as if I needed light to live, needed it as much as air. At 8, I came out of this experiment reassured with the sense that I was being reborn. Since it was not I who was making the light, since it came to me from outside, it would never leave me. I was only a passageway, a vestibule for this brightness. The seeing eye was in me. Still, there were times when the light faded, almost to the point of disappearing. It happened every time I was afraid. If, instead of letting myself be carried along by confidence and throwing myself into things, I hesitated, calculated, thought about the wall, the half-open door, the key in the lock, if I said to myself that all these things were hostile and about to strike or scratch, then, without exception, I hit or wounded myself. When he stepped outside of that total presence that he defined as light, then it was very different for him. And we who are sighted, as we go about our life, when we step out of life by living in our ideas, in our thoughts, in our conditioning, reacting to things instead of responding. That's how it is, isn't it? It's through our practice that we can return to what was inborn in us, which is much as he's describing this light. The only easy way to move around the house, the garden, or the beach was by not thinking about it at all, or thinking as little as possible. Then I moved between obstacles the way they say bats do. What the loss of my eyes had not accomplished was brought about by fear. It made me blind. Anger and impatience had the same effect, throwing everything into confusion. The minute before I knew just where everything in the room was, but if I got angry, things got angrier than I. They went and hid in the most unlikely corners, mixed themselves up, turned turtle, muttered like crazy men, and looked wild. As for me, I no longer knew where to put hand or foot. Everything hurt me. This mechanism worked so well that I became cautious. When I was playing with my small companions, if I suddenly grew anxious to win, to be first at all costs, then all at once I could see nothing. Literally, I went into fog or smoke. I could no longer afford to be jealous or unfriendly, because as soon as I was, a bandage came down over my eyes and I was bound hand and foot and cast aside. All at once a black hole opened and I was helpless inside it. But when I was happy and serene, approached people with confidence and thought well of them, I was rewarded with light. So is it surprising that I loved friendship and harmony when I was very young? Armed with such a tool, why should I need a moral code? For me, this tool took the place of red and green lights. I always knew where the road was open and where it was closed. I had only to look at the bright signal, which taught me how to live. It was the same with love, but let us see how. The summer after the accident, my parents took me to the seashore. There I met a little girl my own age. I think she was called Nicole. She came into my world like a great red star, or perhaps more like a ripe cherry. The only thing I knew for sure was that she was bright and red. I thought her lovely, and her beauty was so gentle that I could no longer go home at night and sleep away from her because part of my light left me when I did. To get it all back, I had to find her again. It was just as if she were bringing me light in her hands, her hair, her bare feet on the sand, and in the sound of her voice. How natural that people who are red should have red shadows. When she came to sit down by me between two pools of salt water under the warmth of the sun, I saw rosy reflections on the canvas of the awnings. The sea itself, the blue of the sea, took on a purple tone. I followed her by the red wake which trailed behind her wherever she went. Now, if people should say that red is the color of passion, I should answer quite simply that I found that out when I was only 8 years old. And how could I have lived all that time without realizing that everything in the world has a voice and speaks? Not just the things that are supposed to speak, but the others, like the gates, the walls of houses, the shade of trees, the sand, and the silence. Still, even before my accident, I loved sound, but now it seems clear that I didn't listen to it. This blindness caused him to really tune in, to truly be present with life, exactly what we're working towards through our practice. And this is why, eventually, many, many years later, when he was teaching in the United States, university classes, after the war was over and he was able to, with a certain amount of challenge met, get an education, because at that point in time, the Nazis still had created some laws in French about people who were not whole and complete in as defined by the Nazis. And one of those laws was that if you were blind, you could not attend university. But somehow he was able to do that and to get advanced degrees, and so he was able to teach. And we have this book because his American students were so drawn to him and so taken by his demeanor, his ability to flow with life, that they asked him about his life and what made him that way. Many people assume that being blind is a curse. For him, it was not. It was a door opening into something deeper and more profound. We have that same doorway within ourselves, and we don't need to go blind except to our conditioning and our assumptions and our thoughts about ourselves and our relationship in the world. When we allow ourselves to live in each moment fresh and clear and open, untinged by this conditioning, we too can be as free as he was. He was fortunate that as a child, as he said, he hadn't yet formed a lot of habit patterns of fixity about life. And so he was able to remain flexible and learn these things about how to live without the normal sight that we take for granted. Our practice will take us to that same place. If we're willing to do the work, as you've heard so many times, the practice will show us where we're caught. Just as his blindness showed him, if he was anxious to win, putting himself first, angry or upset, that way of being able to see was gone temporarily. And we can see through our practice what it is that is keeping us from living in that free way. And then we have a choice. If we're willing to accept those, well, let's just say that each time I saw those things about myself, I would wince. These are not the kind of things you want to think are your qualities, think are the things that you've done. Think of how you've been with people or things. But in seeing them more clearly, or seeing them clearly for the first time ever, it gives us an opportunity to tune in, feel the disappointment or the remorse, and to build the commitment not to live like that anymore. And then it's easy, because that commitment has been made seriously and completely. And while the habit pattern of reaction may come up again, it's weakened. And when we tune in again, it's weakened further, and eventually it simply won't come up again. And we'll live differently. And then, of course, more subtle things become clear to us. And we have those to work with as well. This practice truly is miraculous. It really does show us where we're caught if we're willing to take a look. And I hope we all are, because that's the way to let go of these caught places and not to go there again. Turn the light inside, trace down the radiance to its source. With each out-breath, reach. Go beyond words, beyond thoughts, beyond ideas, beyond whatever you're thinking about or however you're feeling in the moment. Doesn't matter whether you're too hot or too cold or too tired or too restless or anything else. Right in the middle of that, dive and explore. In that way, eventually you will become free. You have everything you need to accomplish this. And right now, we're on the second day of Sesshin, actually quite a bit through the second day of Sesshin. It's been going very well. You've all been working hard. Keep doing it, and you won't be disappointed. Just persist, regardless of what it feels like in the moment. Just persist as deeply and clearly as you can. Even if your head is filled with a million thoughts, drop deep Let those thoughts be the surface of the foam on the waves, and dive to the bottom where it's quiet and calm, and search there. Thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.